I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome back to Radio Times. While the lead found in Flint, Michigan's water has been front page news, lead has posed a public health problem across the country for years. Here on the East Coast, the main source of high lead levels comes from chipping and peeling paint from older deteriorating houses common in cities like Philadelphia and Trenton, New Jersey. Young children living and playing in that environment can develop learning and behavioral problems because of exposure to lead. This hour of Radio Times, what to do about this preventable problem. And we have three guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Let me introduce them to you. Nan Filer, visiting professor of law and the Phyllis W. Beck Professorship of Law Chair at Temple University Beasley School of Law, formerly the Deputy Commissioner of Public Health Programs for the City of Philadelphia. And Nan Filer, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Also with us is Elise Pivnik, Director of Environmental Health at IELTS. And that's a community development environmental organization based in Trenton. She's also a board member of the National Center for Healthy Housing based in Washington, D.C. Elise Pivnik, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you.
And rounding out our trio of guests is Hans Kirsten, an attending physician, also medical director of the GROW Clinic at St. Christopher's Hospital for Children in Philadelphia, also a professor of pediatrics at Drexel University College of Medicine. Hans Kirsten, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Glad to be here.
You're very welcome. And Nan, let me begin with you. And as I said in my introduction, it really was Flint, Michigan that has gotten people talking a lot about the problem of lead, even lead poisoning. But this has been an issue and a problem for some time now. Has this been a public service, if I can almost put it that way, from Flint to get us to thinking once again about the problem of lead?
Well, that's what we think, that it's really an opportunity to begin to raise, really to return to some awareness that I think has been kind of reduced in recent years, that we still have a crisis of lead poisoning, and we actually have the opportunity to do prevention if we'd really focus, and particularly on the old housing stock of places like Philadelphia, places in New Jersey, throughout the state even. Pennsylvania has the fourth highest number of houses built before 1978 when lead paint was restricted. In Philadelphia, 90% of our housing is built before 1978.
90%.
And that, when you combined with sort of poverty and issues around home maintenance. So we have little kids who are really put at risk from the housing conditions they live in, and really still very significant numbers of children who are at risk or actually living with lead poisoning.
Elise, give us a sense of what's happening in Trenton.
So, well, in Trenton and then in New Jersey. So in Trenton, we know that about twice as many children per year are coming up with levels of 5 and above, or just high lead levels, compared to Flint when you compare data for the same year. And, you know, this is obviously it's a long-term problem. And when the Flint situation hit the news, I said, I'll look at the New Jersey data. And I saw that. I wasn't surprised to see 11 cities had higher levels than Flint. And it's a long-term problem. And while there's been a lot of progress, you know, children that are living in these older cities are still at risk. And clearly parents who live in Newark and Trenton don't think we have solved the problem.
And we are talking, I mean, it's not just one source, but broadly speaking, we're talking about old lead paint in old deteriorating houses. That's what peeling off the walls, the kids play with it.
Right. And it turns into dust when you have lead paint on a window and the window goes up and down. You've got that friction. And then the image we like to use is that the amount of lead dust that can fit in a sugar packet from a restaurant that is scattered on the floor, a toddler goes through it, puts her hands in her mouth, and you could have the beginning of lead poisoning. It's a very, it can be an invisible problem.
Well, let me turn to you, Hans, because you're a physician. You see your office or you work at St. Christopher's, which is in the Kensington section of Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. Are you seeing a lot of children with lead poisoning or higher lead levels in their blood?
Absolutely. I think talking to Nan, it seems like 10% of the children in Philadelphia have elevated levels. So it's certainly 1 in 10 kids, and it used to be a lot higher. But as Elise was saying, it is invisible. It's not something you can look at them and be able to see, so it really revolves around screening. I would say that the Flint is very unfortunate, but it is an opportunity to shed light on an old problem. It's something that's very prevalent. Remember that 40% of the children in Philadelphia live in poverty. And so this 90% of homes that were built before 1978, many of these children live in homes that have peeling or chipping paint. And that's when it starts to become a problem. This peeling and chipping paint falls on the floor. Lead paint actually tastes very sweet. Uh-huh. And so it kids like the taste of it. It gets in the dust from the windows and doors and porches. And then toddlers in particular who play around are going to get it on their toys and put it in their, the hand-to-mouth behavior sets them up for lead poisoning.
Use the word invisible, meaning that there aren't symptoms, sort of obvious symptoms, if a child has been exposed high levels of lead?
So yes and no. The most prevalent, we're talking about levels that are less than 5, and there are not symptoms that you might see that, of these children. Some of them may have problems with attention or behavior. But actually, before we had blood lead levels, they used to diagnose it by seizures and other very severe symptoms that they had. We're way beyond that now, and that rarely does occur. But most of the kids, an overwhelming majority of the children that we see are the regular children that we would see in our clinics.
And is it unsafe at all levels? I mean, any level of lead?
There is no acceptable level of lead in the human body.
We were talking about this, Nan, before going on the air, the fact you have to go back to before 1978, paint had lead in it. There was gasoline that had lead in it. So I'm looking at all four of us. We probably grew up at a time when there was a lot more lead in the environment. Was it a bigger problem back then, or are we talking about some unique features today?
Well, I think it's a combination. I think it is a great public health success that the numbers of children who are exposed to high levels of lead in their blood and have those problems has really been reduced. The problem is that there's a lot of cofactors. There's a lot of other issues that children face, as Hans was talking earlier before we went on the air. These are kids that many in Philadelphia, for example, and kids who are particularly exposed to lead have other issues that makes the lead poisoning sort of almost exacerbate and deal with learning disabilities and other issues that on top of other problems. I think the other issue that we're seeing is these houses where there's chipping and peeling paint have other conditions that put kids' health at risk. So we're really looking at the broader issue from a public health standpoint, how to really deal with the crisis of a deteriorating old housing stock. With lead being one of the most serious risks that we see.
Elise, going back to you, I mean, this is a preventable problem, right? I mean, if we're talking about deteriorating paint, then paint the houses with, you know, new paint that doesn't have oil. I mean, excuse me, doesn't have lead
paint
in it.
Yeah, sure. Indeed, it's a preventable problem. And, you know, one of the things we know when we talk about the other socioeconomic factors that affect a child's life, what we know is it's pretty hard. We don't have the answers to solving chaotic families and poverty, but we do know that if we make a home lead safe, that's a one-time intervention, and that home will be safe forevermore. So we can do something about it. And I think a big problem is that right now the way our national system works, state systems work, is that we wait until a child has a level of 5 or above, or in New Jersey's case it would be 10 or 15 above, until we intervene. And that's like, you know, using the canary in the coal mine, using children as the canary in the coal mine to detect lead. What we need to be doing, and I think all public health experts agree, is that we need to do prevention and we need to get into the homes proactively. So at Isles, we've been testing homes for the last 8 years, and we've tested over about 2,000 houses in Trenton. We use dust sampling methods, and 60% of them shouldn't be lived in by children.
Really?
So the levels are high. We see it. These are old houses. And we're looking for ways where you can get proactive inspections going. We're looking for ways that we can subsidize housing inspection departments throughout in these high-risk cities. So families can call in and say, I'm worried about my child. I just received a letter 2 days ago where someone was asking, what should I do? I have a baby being born, and I don't know what to do.
I think don't know what to do. Let me go back to you, though. I was reading about in New Jersey, you do have the Lead Hazard Control Assistance Fund, and this is money that's a tax actually on paint cans.
Yeah.
And there's been millions of dollars a year accumulated over time. Looking at the current Governor Christie, and I think Governor Corzine before him, raided some of this money to use in the general fund.
Indeed. And one of the big things that we're working on now is getting the governor to restore that money. We feel it's a very essential tool for giving low-income homeowners and landlords who rent to low-income tenants the funding that they need to make a home lead safe. And it's an important tool in the arsenal. You can do all the education you want, but if you're not doing something to remove the lead exposure, you're not really getting to the root of the problem.
Nan, how about in Philadelphia?
Unfortunately, I think this does reflect a lack of a funding priority. The problem is, to just reiterate, this is preventable. It's very serious. It's long-term, and you really can't treat a child, certainly at lower levels. So we really should be investing in prevention, but it costs money. And there's no funding right now in Philadelphia or, I think, in Pennsylvania or New Jersey for a family to go to for a lead inspection.
If they, say, owned the house and
yes,
wanted
to do inspection, which is what you need to do, and then the remediation. In Philadelphia, the city does have HUD funding to do about 100 houses a year, and it's limited right now to children who have been tested with a lead level of 10 micrograms per deciliter, even though the reference level we should be working at is 5 and above. There's limited interim control that the city does for children 5 to 10 or at risk. But when you look at the number of children and the number of houses, and this is something that a lot of families can't put out the money to do. So the National Center for Healthy Homes is calling for $230 million a year over 10 years to try to address every house built before 1960.
Hans, going back to you, is it standard then since you work in Philadelphia, to test all children to do a blood test, a test for their lead levels, or is it only under unique circumstances?
No, I think there's routine screening. If you look at children's development, children who are 2 have the most kind of hand-to-mouth activities, and so those are the children that are at greatest risk for developing lead poisoning. And so if you look at the CDC, our national organization says that we need to be aware of, pediatricians need to be aware of what the levels are in their city or what the risk factors are in their city and state and develop plans to do that. And so at our hospital, we've communicated with the companies that test the blood lead and make sure that that's communicated with the city, and then we develop a plan around how to do that. One of the other things that Nan and I were talking about earlier that's been very successful is the insurance companies now have to report some of that data.
Oh, really?
So that helps pediatricians in being able to screen. But I would just like to add that, it has tremendous effects on their their IQ, their development, that have lifelong effects on these children. There are studies, Dr. Needleman did studies years ago on the dentin level of the teeth that were some of the first studies. There are studies looking at delinquency and lead poisoning and lots of other things that are associated with it. So there is some studies that look at if we spent the millions and billions of dollars to abate that actually that would save us a lot of money in the long run.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about the problem of lead poisoning here in the Delaware Valley. Much more after this short break, including a fourth guest who's going to join us to talk about lead in the brain. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain, and we're talking about lead and lead poisoning here in the Delaware Valley. A lot of focus has been on the water crisis in Flint, Michigan, but as it turns out, here in the Delaware Valley and along the East Coast, because I guess of the older housing stock, oftentimes lead comes from peeling and chipping and paint dust. I do want to get Jay Schneider in on the conversation, a professor in the Department of Pathology, Anatomy, and Cell Biology at Thomas Jefferson University. He has been studying the effects of lead on children. And Jay Schneider, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, thank you. So nice to be with you.
Nice to have you with us. And I know you were listening in. Basically, I guess broadly speaking, what is the effect of lead on a developing brain?
Well, unfortunately, lead is an extremely potent neurotoxin that has detrimental effects on the developing nervous system at very low levels of exposure. The presence of lead in the brain can cause damage through a wide variety of mechanisms, and it can cause direct effects on both the structure of the nervous system and the function of the nervous system. So during development, lead can affect the growth of nerve cells. It can affect the growth of the processes that connect nerve cells to one another, so that it can negatively impair the ability of information to be transmitted through the brain. It can affect a wide variety of key molecules that are involved in the transfer of information from cell to cell, things that are that we call neurotransmitters, and it can adversely affect the way these neurotransmitters are made and the way that they are released and even the way that the next neuron in the line responds to these chemicals. So the effects are wide wide-ranging. And
is that at any level, and or and does it vary from child to child? Is it different in boys versus girls? Is there any variability there?
So those kinds of effects occur at extremely low levels of exposure, at least below the 5 microgram per deciliter limit that has that we currently use as a reference for poisoning in children. There are sex effects, and that is actually quite interesting, and it's something that we've really been learning a lot more about, that there is appear to be a sex specificity, but it's interesting that it doesn't identify one sex as being more vulnerable than the other, but it highlights different profiles of effects of lead on the nervous system that are modified by sex.
Are these effects or these changes or this damage, is that permanent? Is it something a child could outgrow as they grow and develop?
Unfortunately, these effects appear to be permanent. And one of the scarier aspects of this, as we're learning from studies that are currently in progress, that are looking at a molecular level, what it is that lead can do to the brain and to nerve cells. We know that early development is a well-known period of vulnerability of the brain. It's a time in which brain systems are undergoing a substantial amount of development that needs to proceed in a very highly organized and well-orchestrated fashion in order to put together a normal functioning brain. And it's being increasingly understood that environmental conditions such as lead poisoning during these kinds of critical periods have the potential to actually reprogram the way that the brain is structured and functions. And this reprogramming can occur through something that's called an epigenetic alteration. And what epigenetics refers to are molecular modifications of our DNA that can switch particular genes on or off based on chemical modifications that have been made to the DNA. And we're now learning that these kinds of chemical modifications to your DNA can occur from lead poisoning.
And just, we could go on, but I'm going to put my final question to you. You use the word scared. Should we be scared?
Well, I think it's, you know, as I think the other guests have already discussed, this is really a preventable situation. And I think that we really need to be aware that there is the potential for a tremendous amount of harm to children from exposure to lead. So I think we need to be very concerned that this is still a significant issue.
Well, I appreciate you joining us, Jay Schneider. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Professor in the Department of Pathology, Anatomy, and Cell Biology at Thomas Jefferson University, and as you just told us, has been studying the effects of lead on children. Let me quickly reintroduce everyone sitting around the table here with me. Lise Pivnik, Director of Environmental Health at IELTS, and that's a community-based organization based in Trenton, New Jersey. Nan Filer, Visiting Professor of Law, the Phyllis W. Beck Professorship of Law Chair at Temple University Beasley School of Law, former Deputy Commissioner of Public Health Programs for the City of Philadelphia, and Hans Kirsten, an attending physician and medical director of the GROW Clinic at St. Christopher's Hospital for Children, which is in Philadelphia. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Hans, let me just pick up on something that Jay Schneider was talking about, and since you deal with families and with children that might test for or do test for these levels of lead in their blood. Is there something a family can do if their child, you tell them that their child has a high level or a too high level of lead? What does a family do about that?
Well, the important thing is that they get tested. And as we said, a lot more families seem to be getting tested. But once it's elevated, as we've all been trying to say, we need to try to help the family as best we can. I look at it as kind of a social determinant of health, that there are a lot of things that affect children, and lead poisoning is one of them that has very significant effects. So what we do in our clinic is we send a letter to the family letting them know mm-hmm. that they'll need to get a repeat test in a period of time. We forward that level onto the city Department of Public Health. As Nan was saying, at levels above 10, that the city will come out and inspect the home. There are certain modifications they can do. There's some evidence that eating healthy diets with calcium and iron and other things can help decrease the absorption of lead. And also kind of cleaning the house. You know, there are remediation effects. We were mm-hmm. talking about the benefits of that, that families certainly should be aware and be educated about it and take care of their homes. But there are larger effects that, you know, we could prevent this problem if we were able to do stuff on a larger scale.
And if you're testing a child over time, do those levels go up and down? Or does it pretty much sort of maintain whatever that initial level is?
Long-term studies that I've looked at show that they generally peak about 2 years of age based on children's development and how they're exposed. The problem with children is that lead is absorbed to a greater detail than it is in adults, and it's the half-life is dependent that it's stored in bones, and the half-life in bones is on the order of years. And so it takes a very long time for levels to go. And their levels are really based on what the exposure is. So when we get a lead level, it's really reflective of what environment they're exposed in, whether it's at home, which is most common, but we also see it at daycares or other places that the children are cared for. So it's really a flag that they're being exposed somewhere.
Nan, is this a civil rights issue?
I think it is. I think it's really a social justice issue, and it's really about access to healthy environments for children, particularly looking at the indoor environment. Along with funding, I think that also calls forth the need for aggressive enforcement of our laws that could protect children from these exposures. Both development of the laws, but as Philadelphia has, for example, there are good laws in place that I can talk about. Both the housing property codes around the nation really mandate that property has to be in stable condition without chipping and peeling paint. In Philadelphia, we have a law requiring landlords mm-hmm. to actually test for lead hazards and give notice to families. We have lead court in Philadelphia. But we like the funding to remediate the homes. Historically, it's been very difficult to enforce the laws aggressively. And I think if you think about it, the purpose of the laws is to deter behavior. You want landlords, you want property owners to invest in their property to comply with the law to prevent. So I think along with looking at how we're going to help pay for this, mm-hmm. we really need to look at how seriously we're taking the health and safety hazards that are in children's homes.
You want to add something? Go ahead, Elise.
I think I wanted to share. There's the state of Rhode Island and city of Rochester. They have had they've required a lead safe certificate for landlords to have before they can rent out a house. And there's just been some research by Professor Janet Curry at Princeton University and Anna Azer at Brown University, which shows that if you require that lead safe certificate and you enforce it, that they're showing that you can see a reduction in the racial disparities in education by 54%.
Wow.
It's powerful, powerful data.
Because of the effect on cognition, I guess, and,
right.
and the growing and developing brain, perhaps lead on top of other stressors, you've got children put at a disadvantage.
Right. Mm-hmm. And you're reducing their exposure to that toxin.
Let me go back to you, Nan, and you brought in some of the same research that I had as well, looking at counties or cities even beyond Philadelphia, and some of them having, I mean, looking at Allentown, Altoona, Bethlehem, I mean, higher levels in Flint, Michigan, for instance.
That's right. I think, we don't want to denigrate the fear and the reality of the issues around Flint, but the reality is what I've read most recently is the level in Flint was around 3 or 4 of lead poisoned children, which we worry about. But there's 21 out of the 67 counties in Pennsylvania where more than 10% of the children have an elevated blood level. In the United States, there's over 500,000 kids. And in Pennsylvania, there's 13,000 kids with elevated levels. So it's really and it isn't, as you said, across the board. It tends to track where there's poverty and there's older housing. So we really can be strategic about this as well, that I think makes it a cost-effective strategy, not that could really help us make a dent in this problem.
I was reading about something called ghost factories, and these are factories where they used to make lead paint or used to use lead material. They're now closed. Some of them, from having worked in Kensington, I remember those large factories there. Is that a threat now?
Well, what people think there, for example, many smelters were in Philadelphia, and there's been some studies of soil. And my reading of the science anyway is that it's a kind of a cofactor. In other words, there is the issue of lead in the soil that can be tracked into the home. My reading is that it's not as predominant a risk as the paint in the home, but right. it's kind of an additional risk.
I would agree with that.
Yeah.
Okay. We had a lot of people that want to talk to us. Let's get Patricia from Germantown to join our conversation. And Patricia, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello. I'm Patricia. I am a public health consultant and former deputy commissioner of public health. In the process of my work, I learned that Medicaid requires that children under the age of 6 be screened for their lead levels. And in 2014, I'm looking at the report, only 115,000 children were even screened in Pennsylvania, which seems to me is one simple way of addressing, beginning to address the issue. Children have to be screened before they can be diagnosed or treated.
Sure.
And that's simply not happening.
Well, that's interesting. And I'm looking at you, Hans. What she's saying is that if you're on Medicaid, that there should be automatic screening, yes?
Yeah, so what Nan and I were talking about earlier is that Medicaid is, I think, helped to screen somewhat because it requires that they get reporting about children's lead levels, which is very good. But part of the problem is that it's not just the parent, but it's also the pediatrician or providers. They have to recognize the importance of screening as well. And so there is some, although we have very good levels here in Philadelphia, it's again, we have to remain vigilant about screening because, this unfortunate thing that happened in Flint has shed light on an old problem that continues to be a problem.
You want to add something, Elise?
Right. In New Jersey, we're working on a bill that would require children to submit their lead screening level at the time of school entry or preschool entry.
Oh, wow.
And that which gets counted gets done. So if you can't get into your preschool program or whatever, you will be sure to have your lead test. And we feel like that it will be a very important incentive to get children tested.
We have an email from Matt. Says, I'm a house painter. What role does my industry play in both creating and resolving the problem of lead paint poisoning in old houses? And I'm assuming before 1978 or back in the early 20th century, Nan Company, we didn't know about the problems of lead?
Well, I think we didn't know or we didn't take action until 1978, and certainly since then it's made a big difference. The one point that's important to make actually sure. to house painters, and I so appreciate that call, and anyone who does any work in old housing, is both the law and good practice requires that you use lead-safe work practices. There's an additional risk. We've seen it. They've seen it a lot. We've seen it with the city, and there's a lot of data to support. Kids are exposed also because through the work done on old houses, lead dust gets stirred up. So it's particularly important that someone like a house painter or anyone who renovates or works in these old housing really takes the necessary precautions. So that's an excellent question.
Sure. Hans, you want to add something?
No, I was just going to say that there's been a tremendous amount of research. It is a potent neurotoxin, but there's been a tremendous amount of research that we've learned in the last 20 or 30 years that really kind of highlights the not just the effects at 10 or 20 or more severe effects, but at levels less than 10 and less than 5. Hmm. So it's actually my favorite Philadelphian, Ben Franklin, commented how long we knew about something before we act mm-hmm. about it. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about lead poisoning. So it's this has shed light on
it. We've known this for a while. We're almost having a break. Comment from Mike. What about from Mike, yes. What about dishes and other glazed products that may contain lead? You're sort of nodding your head there.
Sure. It's a huge danger. And we know that certain ethnic groups, for example, will bring pottery from their home country that can have lead glazes. We know we've tested items that are in the dollar store, and we know that a lot of those can have lead in them. So buyer beware.
Is it on the label?
No. No.
I was even reading about some candies.
Absolutely. Mexican. Yes.
Not just there's pottery from South America, from Mexico may have lead paint. There is a recent movement to include that. But there is also wrappers from certain candies from
Mexico.
South America.
Mexico is in particular.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking about lead. And we have three guests. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about lead poisoning here in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, the Delaware Valley. The main source of that lead poisoning, comes from flaking and chipping paint, from paint dust, and it's almost always found in older homes. And, of course, this is an older part of the United States. And so it is a problem here in Philadelphia, a problem in cities like Trenton as well. And that's what we're talking about with Elise Pivnik, Director of Environmental Health at IELTS, and that's based in Trenton. Nan Filer, Visiting Professor of Law, and the Phyllis W. Beck Professorship of Law Chair at Temple University Beasley School of Law, used to be Deputy Commissioner of Public Health Programs here in Philadelphia, and Hans Kirsten, an attending physician, medical director of the GROW Clinic at St. Christopher's Hospital for Children, which is in the Kensington section of Philadelphia. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me read a couple of comments here and get your comments. Comment from Mike, what about the lead that's in different sources, such as lead in dirt or the environment in different locations, for instance? Can you take that, Nan? I mean, we've been focusing largely on paint because that's really the main problem here. But should people also think about soil and perhaps soil that's next to an old refinery that's no longer around? I'm just making something up here.
Yes, I think that when you work with families and we talk about prevention, you need to also look at the soil. And maybe Elise, I could actually hand this over to you because we were talking about it before.
Indeed, it's in soil. And if you are next to that industrial site, indeed lead can be there. But the far more prevalent source of poisoning is from the house. And oftentimes it's the house paint that migrates out into the backyards. So you've got paint chips that are falling from the roof line. They fall around the house. The dog gets in them. The children are running around. It gets tracked in and out. And again, go back to that image of the dust that fits in a sugar packet. It does not take much.
I know you work with children, but can you also get lead poisoning as an adult? Are adults also at risk if they're living in some of these environments?
Yes, but I think the pathophysiology is that it's more is absorbed in children and it's kept in bones, which has a longer T1/2. But I know that the people who work on the bridges who repaint the bridges, that they have lead levels that are fouled. But I don't know. I'm not familiar as much with the research on adults.
Go ahead, Elise.
An important fact to understand is that if a young girl was was poisoned as a youngster, and then she becomes pregnant. So when it comes time for the fetus to be pulling calcium out of the bones, instead it might be pulling lead out of the bones. So you haven't. There's the opportunity to be affecting the brain of an unborn child. And also a child can break their leg. They were poisoned when they were 3 years old, and then they break their leg when they're 12. You're opening up again lead to the system.
And it's my understanding it's children that it affects, and also similarly to what you were saying, Elise, that pregnant women also themselves during their pregnancy, if they're exposed to lead dust.
Mm. So if they're living in one of these houses, then...
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yes. It can affect a lot of people, but really the effect I think we're most concerned about is on the growing and developing brain. Mm-hmm. It is a potent neurotoxin for anyone, but in particular the growing and developing brain, and those young children are the greatest risks for the severe effects of lead.
An email from Daniel. Why no discussion of Philadelphia's lead pipes? I mean, these are older houses, some of them having, you know, lead pipes. Is that an issue as well, Hans?
Absolutely. Again, there are lots of different sources. The primary source is lead paint and lead dust. But a number of years ago, they stopped serving water in the Philadelphia School District, I think because a lot of the pipes had lead solder. So lead solder was how pipes were used. Copper in particular were used to be fused together. And water that sits in the pipes overnight can leach out into the water. And so that is a source of concern.
But our water department, and as you know from your show, their view is that the water is safe in Philadelphia, that it's actually the pipes that are near the home, and there's an additive in the water in Philadelphia to deal with the leaching lead. I'm not an expert on that, but I don't want callers to be fearful if, in fact, our experts are saying that water in the home is safe.
No, absolutely. And I think that the city has done a good job of taking care of that. And we talk to families about if there is lead solder or pipes in their homes, if they run the cold water for a minute, then that'll decrease whatever is leached out of the lead solder in the water, and then they'll have clean, healthy, safe water.
There was some research. You made a reference to it, Hans, done in Philadelphia, the fairy tale, the fairy tooth godmother research, something like along that effect, which is looking at the baby teeth of children in the city and then comparing it to suburban children, finding this huge disparity, which this was back in the 70s, making me wonder whether, I mean, in many ways we are talking about urban kids in poor neighborhoods, less about suburban kids. Can you speak to that, Nan?
Well, we do have high levels of lead poisoning, though, in our Delaware Valley. So I think this is something that really, and we shouldn't minimize that any old house will probably have lead paint in it, because while it's layered over with newer paint, there is that potential for chipping and peeling. It may just be a house that's able to be maintained better. But in Montgomery County, Chester County, Delaware County, more than 5%, in Delaware County, 6.65% of children are poisoned. And remember, Flint was closer to 3%, so we're higher in our suburban areas in our Delaware Valley. So we do want to get the message out that this is something that every family should, who lives in a house built before 1978, should be aware of. And screening is universal. The guideline for screening is really for all children.
So go to your pediatrician and get a screening. Let me get Carolyn from, looks like Chestnut Hill, to join us. Hi, Carolyn. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there. We have a terrible phone line, Carolyn. I'm sorry about that. Let me just read what's on the screen here. She says her daughter had a baby recently and a visiting nurse came to her house. Is there any type of program with visiting nurses traveling to homes to check for lead? I mean, is the only way to check for lead is to bring a is get the child or the baby to the doctor's office, right?
Yeah. But go ahead. I'm going to pass it. Nan's raising her hand.
Okay, go ahead, Nan, and then I'll get to you, Elise, and then to you, Hans.
Sorry, I did want to say that and we need to really distinguish between checking the kid, checking the child, and checking the house, which is really the risk. And what the science is pretty clear is that you really need to have a dust wipe test. And not just a visual inspection, but really have somebody, and we recommend certified lead dust wipe technicians and inspectors, actually make sure that that house doesn't have a risk. So a home with an infant it should be checked to make sure that the child's not at risk. The city of Philadelphia has a list of licensed lead risk assessors that is a resource for folks.
There was a program, LeadSafe Homes, where they went out and tested homes of families at risk, and they did find that there were elevated lead dust levels. So lead dust levels are really key measure of how they might be exposed in the future.
So at IELTS, we've continued to test homes, but one of the things we're also working on is training community health workers, anybody who visits a home, to be able to do a healthy homes assessment, including a dust sample when they're there. The idea is that you don't need a special department of healthy homes. You've got a lot of people that are visiting a home of a poor family for multiple reasons, and you can take that opportunity to educate the family and assess the home. And it's important. It's a good way to go because a community health worker visits it's a home more than once typically, whereas if you send out, you know, just an inspector, it's a one-time interaction. So we think there's a lot of promise in combining those professions.
And then the message I think needs to be, if I may,
sure,
if there is an elevated dust level in the home, that lead hazard has to be removed safely as soon as possible, and the children needs to be kept from that lead dust through cleaning and through other interventions.
Yeah, let's say getting back to the house painter, that needs to be done in a safe way because of remodeling it could expose the children to very unsafe levels.
Let me get Lisa from Westchester to join us from Radio Times. Hi, Lisa. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi there. Go ahead, Lisa.
Hi. I guess you guys are just starting to touch upon this a little bit more, but I was going to comment on how critical it is that people just don't know that standard home renovation processes, you know, can really increase the chances and the amount of exposure, I guess, to family members. Just simple stuff like sanding and heat stripping paint is really particularly dangerous. And I think people are sometimes under the impression, oh, you know, just get rid of it. Without a certified lead abatement contractor. And most paint companies, I think, don't specifically have that certification, is my understanding. You have to go through an environmental, environmental business or something like that.
Surely. A lot of people that had questions about this, I can see them on both of my screens here. Elise, did you want to respond to that at all?
Well, very important comment that you've just made. This is, lead poisoning is not something that is only for poor families. And, you know, I know of the cases of, you know, affluent New Jersey cities where a family was doing a rehabilitation and they didn't know any of this information and their children were poisoned. It's important to, this can affect everybody.
Yeah, and go ahead, Nam.
Just for your callers, the EPA has a tremendous amount of information on how to do lead safe work, as well as the law that's related to that. So there's a lot of good information, particularly on the EPA website, to really give good, strong guidelines about when doing renovation.
We have a tweet from Pennsylvania Senator Hughes. He says, what about lead in schools? Philly schools' average age is 69 years old. Has anybody looked at that? I mean,
The risk really has been less in the schools when the kids begin in kindergarten. They're older and there's less exposure. And so while pre-K and home health care, we do worry about it. We do really worry less about the exposure to the lead dust in the schools. There are issues, though, about water. And as Hans said, right now, because of litigation, there are signs in the schools that say do not drink the water because of the lead pipes. And that has an impact on other public health issues because you want children to be able to drink healthy water.
Sure. Let me get John from Mount Airy to join our conversation. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
I'm a painter in Mount Airy, and when I get called to a house to give a price on a job to be done properly, like we're talking about here, it could cost four or five times more than than doing a job without taking all these precautions. And when a customer sees an estimate of 5,000 versus maybe 20,000 to do it properly, you know who they're going to go to.
They're going to go to the cheaper one.
Yeah, that's it. And, you know, that's the bottom line here when people are making decisions of whether they're going to get it done or not.
Yeah. Well, let me find out, because there was some discussion about some of these programs that are in place to get some remediation. I'm looking back at you, Nan.
Well, you know, I'm surprised to hear you say that, because the city of Philadelphia uses when a child is already poisoned and the city goes in and does remediation, or when the workers go in and do impact encapsulation or work in the homes. The experience of the city, I don't think, is that it's quite that cost prohibitive. I know people have some difficulties with the requirements of the law. Certainly what you want to talk to the family about, the cost benefit, and do you want your child to be exposed? And there's other things you can do to sort of minimize the exposure by making sure the kid's not at home. My own experience is that it's not 4 to 5 times more expensive, but I don't know if the other panelists have any experience.
Elise?
I haven't heard that that type of increase.
I mean, I know it's much more expensive, but I don't know exactly how much more it is.
And we're running out of time here. Let me just read a couple of questions Michael had, calling us from Gloucester City, New Jersey. I'm just going to read it, actually. He says, running cold water versus hot water to reduce lead in pipes. Does it matter? You had mentioned that earlier, Hans, about running water. Does it matter if it's hot or cold?
I'm not sure, but the recommendations are to use cold water. I think that the concern is that hot water might leach more lead out of the solder or the pipes, but I haven't seen the research on that.
Are you concerned, Elise, that, you know, we're all talking about lead now because of what happened in Flint, Michigan, that within 6 months' time, this will be a forgotten topic?
Of course I'm worried about that. So we are doing our best to change some policies now. There's been a lot of interest from our state legislators, from our local legislators, and also at the federal level. There's a lot of people that are coming forth, and they're saying, what can we do? So we're working on getting the HUD budget back to $230 million from $110 where it is right now, which gives money to at-risk cities for lead hazard control activities. We're looking at getting better surveillance. We're working on changing HUD rules. Right now, HUD rules are inconsistent with what CDC. You can be living in a Section 8 house and have a child that has a level up to 20 and not have to make any repairs.
Wow.
Right? So there's no one's ever changed that law. So we are working full speed ahead trying to take advantage of this horrible situation. People are paying attention right now, and we're pleased about that, and we're going to do everything we can to keep the issue present,
Hans?
Current.
No, I'm saying it's an unfortunate thing what happened in Flint, but for those of us here, this is a problem that's been going on a long time, and we need to take advantage of that opportunity to do as much work as we can.
Anne?
I would agree. The only thing I would echo, I think, is to keep your eye on the prize. It's really about housing, and we need to also enforce our laws, and we really need to hold all property owners accountable, give them the financial support, give them families the information. But we can prevent this, and I think we really need to take it seriously and look at our housing stock.
We're almost out of time, but what I heard you all sort of say in your own way is that you pay now or you pay later, and it probably makes more sense because it costs more later to deal with not just housing, but perhaps some of the potential problems that a child growing into adult might have.
That's right. Well, you've got the costs in special education. You've got the costs in the juvenile justice system. You've got the cost for an adult, long-term disability, people who are not functioning society. The cost of lead poisoning do not stay in health. They're really in other sectors.
Yeah. Well, on that note, I have to end our discussion. My thanks to all three of you.
Thank you very much.
Pivnik, thanks for coming in from Trenton. And you're welcome, Nan Filer. Thanks for joining us as well.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome. And Hans Kirsten, thank you for coming in as well.
You're welcome.
And go to whyy.org/radiotimes. There were lots of questions and comments here. You can find out much more about the program. Abby Sarfo, the intern this spring for Radio Times. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of the show. And the show is produced by Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.